Welcome to the Digital Story Show, new tools for the creative mind. The Digital Story Show takes you inside with tips for the creative pursuit of photography, music, video, hardware, software, techniques, and hacks. You'll soon find yourself thinking less about buttons and menus and more about expressing the artist inside us all. Now the Digital Story Show with Derek Story.
May 9th, 2006, the Digital Story Show with Derek Story. Today's topic, photo mailbag. Welcome back to the show. I've got lots of reader questions today, and I actually have a few answers to those questions. Now, normally the way that I handle mail that comes into the Digital Story is I will just answer it right back via email, and most of the time that way works just fine. However, as I go along, I often see certain questions that I think everyone would be interested in hearing the answers to. And today, I have a handful of those, and of course, this is something that I'll be doing on a regular basis. Now, the other thing that I have today is a slideshow tip. That's right, a slideshow tip. And why is that? Because May is slideshow month on the Digital Story. That's right. Remember that Photo Magical slideshow showcase that we're running? You've got to get your slideshow entry ready for that. And I thought by giving you tips along the way, it will not only serve as a friendly reminder to be working on the project, but also help you improve your shows. So I'll add the tip on to the end of the show. I'm going to start out by doing a little reader mail, and off we go. Our first question is from Keith Fox. And it's a good one, too. I don't fully understand the reason to use exposure compensation. If I'm shooting a subject with my Digital Rebel and I want to overexpose by one stop, I would switch to manual mode and adjust my aperture and shutter speed until my meter in my viewfinder shows an overexposure. I'm not quite sure why exposure compensation is a feature, though I'm sure the answer is simple enough and I'm just not getting it. It's actually a very good question, Keith, and thanks for sending it in. Here's the way that it works. Yes, manual mode is perfect for adjusting the exposure, okay? And for a long time, 60s, 70s cameras, this was really the only way you had to go. Once program modes and semi-program modes start coming into being, though, and of course program mode being where the camera sets both the aperture and the shutter speed for you, there are times when the meter gets fooled, you want to override it, and that's when we use exposure compensation. It allows you to stay in program mode, but yet override the meter. A typical scenario for this is, of course, you're shooting a portrait, you got a very bright sky, the camera is misreading the shot, it's being fooled by the bright sky, and it's underexposing your subject. Now, there's all sorts of things you can do that we've talked about in the past, but one of them is just re-expose the image by overriding the meter. And this is where you would use your exposure compensation dial. Just take it, and usually in a case like this, I would move it to about a stop and a half overexposure, which would be plus 1.5, shoot another frame, and see how it looks. So the whole deal about why it's there is so that when you're in aperture priority, when you're in program, when you're in shutter priority modes, you can override the meter, okay, without having to switch to manual mode. Now, if you want to go to manual mode, that's perfectly fine, and it's a great way to go. And in fact, exposure compensation doesn't even work in manual mode because the camera's going, hey, buddy, got it, you're in charge, okay. And it turns off the exposure compensation function. But if you are in program mode and you want to make something brighter, for instance, a snow scene, right? The meter's misreading it, it's turning it gray. Hey, snow's white, not gray. Okay, overexposed by a stop or a stop and a half. Or a dark area, let's say a black car that the meter is misreading and it's turning into a gray car. You go, no, black car, underexposed, minus one stop, minus a stop and a half, maybe even minus two stops to underexpose it. That's where exposure compensation comes in really handy. It allows you to stay in the mode that you're in, work quickly, but yet get the right exposure. So thanks a lot for the question, Keith. It's a great one, and I hope the answer helps a lot of you that were kind of wondering about that. My next question is from Darren Dufourne, and he says, I just bought my first DSLR. I had a Minolta 7XI with a kit of lenses, so opted for the Minolta 5D. It's so far pretty cool, but I'm getting garish colors on some brightly colored flowers at close range. Any ideas why? Other shots seem to come out great. Well, Darren, and actually, thank you. You included some sample shots here for me to look at. And he has some pictures of white flowers that look very nice and some lavender flowers that look exposed properly. And then he has a red flower, a very red flower, that's just totally blown out. And this is something that actually you will see in digital cameras, Minolta cameras. I've seen it on some earlier models of Canons and so on and so forth. And digital cameras have a hard time with solid red. The short answer is it sort of blows their mind. Now, as the camera sensors get more sophisticated and the electronics that go with them, this problem is diminishing a lot. And I know with my 5D that I'm using right now, my Canon 5D, it handles those solid reds a lot better than my earlier Canons used to. So they're moving along, but the short answer is, for a lot of cameras, it's just a tough thing for them. And a lot of times, it happens to be one of those subjects you just have to stay away from. So really garishly red flowers sometimes is a better choice to use your film camera than your digital camera, or if it's something that you shoot a lot, then I would try some of the other digital cameras out there and find one that can handle the reds the way that you like. I think the main thing to know, though, and the main answer is that, you know, it's not really anything that you're doing. Okay, now you might want to turn the saturation down a little bit and a few things like that, but generally speaking, this is the way the camera is behaving in this particular situation, so you have to find ways to work around it. Okay, Darren, sorry, I wish I had better news for you there, but at least you know you're not crazy, and that's always something worth knowing. My next question is from Zeke, and he's from Walnut, California, and he's very curious about macro photography. And he has sort of a long thing here. I'm not going to read it, but the gist of it is that right now he's shooting with a Canon A80, which is a very nice compact that has a swivel screen, which makes, I think, macro photography a lot easier. And he wants to move up to a DSLR and was wondering what kind of macro lenses to buy and also wondering about things like ring flash and you know, dual flash brackets and stuff like that. So the reason why I bring this up is that if this is something that a lot of people are interested in, you know, it really deserves its own show. Macro photography really is something that I can talk about for a good half hour and probably should talk about for a good half hour, because we do have to talk about lenses, we do have to talk about lighting, and just a little bit about technique in there. So if it's something that you're interested in, why don't you drop a comment onto the show notes of this show and say, hey, you know, I am kind of interested in macro photography too. Can we talk about it? And so for you, Zeke, the short answer to your question here is that I will have to say that I find macro photography far more satisfying with a digital SLR than with a compact. I think the compacts do a great job. I really do. And they focus close. They have the swivel screens often, but the thing that drives me nuts about them is that their sensors, a lot of times, their focusing system sensors, have a hard time precisely focusing on the point that I want them to. And in macro photography, for me, that's very critical, because if I want to focus on the pistils of a flower, I don't want the focusing system focusing somewhere on the petal and not on the pistils, because as you know, just the slightest difference in focusing point can make or break the shot. So with a DSLR and a good macro lens, and I love some of these lenses that you cite here, the 60mm Canon f2.8 macro, and Canon also makes 100mm, and then also, you know, Tamron makes a really great 100mm macro, as does Sigma. You know, all these are good. If you have a Digital Rebel or one of the cameras that adds magnification, then, you know, I would lean more toward the 60mm macro. If you have a full-frame digital SLR, then I would probably lean more toward the 100mm, because what's going to happen is that your 60 is going to be close to 100 millimeter anyway when you put it on a Rebel or one of the other Canons that doesn't have the magnification factor. So generally speaking, that's the way I would go. I'd go with the 60 for most of the DSLRs, and I do prefer DSLRs to the compacts because if for no other reason, I can get that focusing point where I want it. Then also, I just think they do a better job of dropping out the background and things like that. So there's the short answer. I hope it helps a little bit. And then we'll wait and see if folks want us to do a show on macro, which I think it would be a terrific idea. This next piece of mail, and it's indicative of a lot of mail that I'm getting right now. I just had an article come out in the June 2006 Macworld magazine article. And for those of you that follow some of the things I do, you know that I write for them regularly. I'm one of their contributing writers. So I have an article in the June edition called New Life for Old Photos. Now, you may remember way back when I was working on this article, I actually did a podcast on scanning. And we actually had a pretty good conversation around it. So that tells you a little bit about, you know, the cycle for publishing for magazines as opposed to podcasting. Podcasting, we can do it right away. You know, I'm just working on it. I can fire up the computer and talk about it. Magazines, of course, you know, it's really sometimes months before we actually see what I was been working on. I should also mention that this article, an abridged version of this article, it's pretty long in the printed version of the magazine, is online, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes for this show. So if you're interested about taking old photographs, old family photographs, or photos that you have stashed under the bed, and the whole kind of workflow for scanning them and cataloging them and doing and retouching them a little bit and doing stuff like that, that whole workflow from, you know, soup to nuts, then you might want to either pick up a copy of Macworld magazine, the June edition, or go to the link that I have that at least gives you the gist of it. The link online gives you the gist of it, and the magazine really details it out a lot more. It's really an interesting subject, and I'm getting a lot of mail on it. Now, one piece of mail that I got here from David, and he's referring to the article, David F., and he says, please add a sidebar for your thoughts on slide scanners as well as slide adapters for flatbeds, and that would be really useful. Okay, so in the article, I do focus mainly on flatbeds, although I do talk some about slide scanners, and I give resolution settings for both flatbeds and slide scanners, because I think that's very important. But to talk a little bit more about slide scanning, there are really two brands that I like of slide scanners, Nikon and Minolta. I think both of them make really excellent slide scanners, and generally speaking, I haven't seen anything by anyone else that has swayed me away from that. And it's one of the things that's on my checklist when I go to trade shows and stuff. I always make sure I check out all the scanners and seeing what's going on in scanning. Now, the reason why I like the Nikon and Minolta scanners is because, first of all, they're very advanced. They're very smart. The Nikon scanners tend to cost a little bit more, but they're also a little bit better with things like, you know, auto-loading and stuff like that. So if you're doing a whole bunch of slides, if you're doing a whole batch of slides, the Nikon scanners are pretty good for that, but you pay a premium. The Minolta scanners are have come around also, and I think their lower-end ones now do have some auto-loading features that are very nice. Both of them feature digital ice, which I think is very important, because no matter how well you blow off your source material, your slides, or your negatives, there's always going to be very small particles of stuff on there. And these scanners are magnifying these images so much that even something that you can't see, you know, in room light with your glasses on might show up in your scan as a blemish. And what digital ice does is that during the scanning process, it identifies some of these blemishes that you may have missed during cleaning, and it actually removes them for you. It's a real time saver and really something to have. So the short answer to my question is that, or to your question, is that take a look at both the Nikon line and the Minolta line, compare the features, figure out what your budget is, and then go with what you can afford, and I think you'll be very happy either way. As for the Macworld article itself, New Life or Old Photos in the June edition, it's really kind of cool. And I think actually after it's been out there for a bit, and if I continue to get mail on and everything, I'll sort of gather together the mail. And I think we have another good podcast in the subject area. But in the meantime, as I said earlier, you might want to check out the article or at least click on the link that I'll give you in the show notes and see if this is maybe something that, you know, we should continue the conversation about here on The Digital Story. Now I have an iTunes question from Pierre and Jen. And they said, however, I have a problem. He said that he really likes the podcast, which I appreciate. I have a problem. In the iTunes podcast directory, I can only see the last two episodes, in this case 29 and 30. How can I download the previous episodes? I tried saving the MP3 files from your side onto my hard drive and then importing them using the add file to library, but these only add the podcast to the songs library, not the podcast directory itself. Any tips there? Well, iTunes is a wonderful and mysterious thing all at the same time when you're a podcaster, because on one hand, it's great because it's a very convenient way for people to find out about your show, to download it, and to, you know, organize it in a very nice, easy-to-use interface. The thing about it is that there are certain mysteries about working with iTunes from a podcasting side that aren't always really clear. We have to submit these XML files that call out certain parameters, and sometimes it's easy to get lost in the code and so forth. To my knowledge, and I'm not an expert on this, so if someone in the audience knows more about this, please add a comment to the show notes. To my knowledge, I don't have a way to control how many of my previous podcasts are listed in the iTunes music library. So generally speaking, it'll hold three for a while, and then it'll drop it down to two. You can always get the latest two or three, but nothing beyond that. Now, as mentioned in the letter, of course, I have all of the podcasts listed on the Digital Story site, and you can go get those anytime you want. And you can actually add them back to your iTunes music library, but they don't show up under the podcast label in the iTunes music library. They become, you know, basically they're treated like songs, and you can create a new album called TDS podcast or whatever, and keep them all there so they're easy to find. But if you're really stuck on having them show up under the podcast header in your iPod, then that's something that I don't know how to hack off the top of my head. So if someone out there has some information about this, go ahead and add a note, and I think we would all appreciate it. It's kind of an interesting thing. In the meantime, just remember, if you're gone for a while and you miss a number of shows, you can always go to thedigitalstory.com, click on the podcast button at the top of the page, and it will list all the podcasts that I've done, you know, forever. And you can grab any of those MP3 files and load them into your music player or listen to them on your computer and organize them any way that you want. And also, if you want the show notes for any of the past shows, then all you have to do is just click on the show notes button. You'll get the same thing. And also in the show notes, always at the end of the show notes, there's a link to download the podcast there too. So on my end, I am the archive, and I will hold everything for you. On iTunes side, well, you know, I'm just happy that they're there and that they're publishing this stuff for us, because a lot of you, listen to the show and get the show through iTunes. I know, because I watch the server stats and I see when the spikes are. For today's slideshow tip, actually, I want to call your attention to a blurb I put on the Digital Story back on Sunday, I believe. And I just want to talk a little bit more about it, because I think it's really kind of important. The title of the post on the Digital Story is something like, use existing signs for your titles. Okay, now what I'm talking about there is that, yes, for slideshows, you can kind of create those graphical titles, you know, where you have a little bit of Photoshop or you use the tools within the application, such as Photomagico, and you create a nice kind of standard looking, you know, Joe's story about his trip to Mexico kind of thing. And those are fine, especially at the opening and closing of things. But inside, you may or may not want to always use those graphical titles. Sometimes it can end up looking a little bit like a Charlie Chaplin movie. Okay, so a more elegant way and kind of a creative way to do this is that while you're gathering your source material for your slideshow, while you're out taking pictures, remember to take pictures of physical signs and placards. And this is a tip that I just think is good for photography anyway, because there's often a lot of information that's out there posted in the world that, you know, is available to us where we have digital cameras. So, you know, why not burn a frame or two on these things and get that information? And then that way you have it so you know what's going on with the images that are associated with it. And in the case of a slideshow, you can even use these signs and placards creatively. Now, one of the things that I think is really neat to do, if you find an informative placard and it's talking about something that you're featuring in your slideshow, in my case, I was using a placard from the Wolf House Ruins, which was a house that Jack London was building. He was going to basically retire in it, and right before he was ready to move in, it caught fire and burned to the ground. So they actually had the floor plan drawn out in one of these placards there when you're looking at the ruins, so you could see where all the different rooms are. And I took a picture of that, high resolution, and it's a very handy thing to have because, for instance, if I were doing a presentation on that, then not only do I have that schematic, that drawing, but I could use the tools in the slideshow to actually zoom in on one of the areas of that drawing to go right to an area that I want to focus on or talk about or that I have other pictures of. And so not only is it informative, it's a very nice effect to have this drawing and to slowly zoom in on it, right, using your slideshow tools as part of your presentation. Now, one thing that's important about when you're shooting things that are rectangular, okay, or square, such as placards and signs, is that make sure that the plane of your camera, right, where the sensor is, or, you know, which is usually the camera itself, is parallel, dead parallel, to the plane of the subject. The reason why is that helps eliminate distortion. Okay, that will help make your item look square or rectangular and not skewed. It won't be keystoning on you. So keep the plane of your camera parallel to the plane of your subject. And then also try to have the center of the lens on the camera pretty much aimed at the center of the sign itself. If you do that, if you keep things centered and you keep the planes parallel, you'll get a nice squared up looking shot that you won't have to fool around with in Photoshop to use. And, you know, that's the thing about when you're working on these slideshows and stuff. They're already enough work as they are without you having to constantly go into Photoshop to, you know, try to fix a skewed sign or something like, you know, you found the right thing. You just want to use it. You just want to grab it and drop it in there. You don't want to fool around with it for 20 minutes before you do that. So a little extra care while you're shooting will go a long ways on using these things. And really think about this because it's a great way to communicate what's going on in your presentation without actually having to use voiceover or, you know, without having to use a graphical sign, a graphical title. It's something to think about, and it's a hope, and I hope it's a tip that you try. So the last thing that I do want to talk about today is the slideshow showcase itself. And I have the rules posted there, you know, at the end of the entry form there, and you can see everything. And I will continue to post links to all that stuff as I post the tips. And so there should always be something around the front page that'll help you navigate to the entry form. Now, the way that it works is that I have an entry form that's very easy to fill out. It's just a web form, and it's right there on the site. So you just click on the link. It takes you to the entry form. You just fill out the information, your name and the title of the show and all that kind of stuff. The rules are at the end of the web form so that you can review them. And then you just click a box to say that you agree with them. So that way we know that you read them. And then you hit the submit button. And then I get all that information. And then we're starting to catalog the entries now. Now, you don't actually have to have your slideshow ready to enter. Okay. To be fully entered. The entry form just really gets us the information up front so we know who's working on slideshows and what they're working on. And it helps us with our planning because when the final date comes in, which is June 15th, when you actually have to upload your slideshow, then we're prepared for about how many slideshows we're looking at. And, you know, there's, you know, a lot of bandwidth involved here, so we want to be as ready as possible. So once you know the name of your slideshow and a little bit of information about it, if you go ahead and send in the entry form now, then that's a great help. And then know that you have until June 15th to submit the presentation itself. And of course, if you change your mind on something, you can always submit another entry form with the updated information and just put in the note, replaces my previous entry. And still, you know, it has been a good thing for us because you're on our radar and we were, you know, planning for your slideshow to come in by June 15th. And along those lines, I just think this is something I really hope you do. It's a great way to learn how to make effective slideshows. And as I've said so many times, effective slideshows are a great way to present your work to the world. And I think once you really get your system down, you're going to be very happy that you've done this and you'll use it time and time again. All right. Well, I think that pretty much wraps it up for today. Grab shots, looking great. Continue to send those in and I'll continue to publish them. I got a little, you know, kind of a little rhythm going, you know, with technical stuff, newsy stuff, and then a grab shot sort of a thing going on. And then, of course, you know, the photo assignment for May is a slideshow as part of the slideshow showcase. So I hope you keep working on that. Keep sending in your questions. I got lots to talk about, and we'll just keep this party going. All right. Have a great week, and I'll see you next week. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Your questions and comments, email them to questions@thedigitalstory.com. For show notes, web blogs, and informative articles, visit www.thedigitalstory.com. We'll see you next time on The Digital Story.